WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Many teachers and principals find that no matter how idealistic they are, it can be very difficult to create effective change in a system so beset by institutional problems. My guest, Madeline Cartwright, is a Philadelphia elementary school principal who has spent the last 5 years trying to make the Blaine Elementary School in the Strawberry Mansion section of Philadelphia a safe, attractive place with a warm and caring atmosphere where children learn from a solid curriculum. When she arrived in 1979, Blaine was considered a typical ghetto school, as they say. Cartwright, with the help of parents, scrubbed it down, fixed it up. She had a washing machine and sewing machine installed so children could be assured of having clean, mended clothes. She organized a credit program for students and parents to ensure that students were equipped with notebooks, pencils, and dictionaries. And she's built up their home and school association, which now raises funds for academic materials, class trips, and other extracurricular activities. Under her direction, the Blaine School was presented with an Academic Achievement Award in 1983 from Superintendent of Schools Constance Clayton. Cartwright's staff recently nominated her for the John N. Patterson Award for Excellence in Public Education, given by the Citizens Committee on Public Education. In their nominating letter, the staff wrote, quote, "Madeline Cartwright had demonstrated an invaluable lesson. This experience has taught us all, children and staff, that uniting our efforts enables us to accomplish things that may have once only been dreams." Cartwright taught in the Philadelphia Public Schools from 1959 to 1978, when she became an administrator. She's also been active in the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers. We're going to discuss some of the current problems in the Philadelphia Public Schools and her approach to making a school work. We hope to open up the phones a little later for your questions and comments. Madeline Cartwright, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm sure you've worked with a lot of principals from your years as a teacher in the Philadelphia Public Schools. As a teacher, what did you think made a principal effective?
Well, I felt that principals were effective when they were available to teachers, parents, and students, when they knew what were the problems of teachers, parents, and students, when they were about the business of making education happen more than making the school stay open.
Had you been a teacher at any schools where there was a really weak principal who didn't give the kind of direction or backup that you expect from them?
I've run into a few, not particularly in schools where I have worked, as I have worked in some schools for a little while. I think I've run into principals who were just not my ideal as to what a principal ought to be. I found that in some instances, they were a bit seemingly afraid of parents, afraid of children, afraid of the teachers' union, afraid of superiors, kind of apprehensive and afraid to really take a chance on trying to affect the kind of change that can be affected with a little courage.
What was the condition of the Blaine School when you arrived there in 79?
Well, it wasn't a bad place. It was kind of a routine elementary school in a poverty area. I kind of described it as drab. It didn't have sparkle. Sparkle not in appearance, outside or in. The front yard was dirt. Just dirt. The grass had not ever been allowed to grow. The inside was kept in a mediocre fashion, and sometimes substandard fashion. It lacked any real sparkle. The youngsters also, they were happy youngsters, but they didn't seem to be involved, really involved in the excitement of education. I'm one that feels that education can be exciting. It takes work, but it can be exciting. I think it's exciting when youngsters and teachers experience success. I think it's exciting when principals experience success. And I didn't feel that kind of a oomph there.
Where did you start? I mean, that's quite a task to take on. What did you do first to try to change the atmosphere of the school?
Well, at first we talked about it with the staff, with the children. I came to meetings with the youngsters every Friday. I talked with them, said to them, how can we make our school better? How can we make you successful? We met with teachers once a week. We have weekly staff meetings. We talked about how can we make the school a better place to educate children, a better place for you to work. We said the same thing with parents. I've had great parent participation, great parent involvement. Our parents come out to our home and school meetings in droves. And we kind of talked about what we could do. We talked about the kind of comradeship that we could have, all of us together. And we worked toward it.
How did you get parents to come out? Were parents' meetings usually well attended before?
I think not. Parents' meetings, I think, generally are not well attended in schools where I had been. At Blaine, I brought the parents out through the children. I said to them, I just have to meet your parents. Your mother has to know me, and I have to know your mother. And constantly I said this. And for the first 3 weeks that I was there, I said to youngsters, bring your mommy to the meeting. The meeting is going to be important. As I passed parents on the yard, I said that to them. And over again, I just said it. So then the last day or so before the meeting, we began to say, whose mother is coming? And then I had youngsters just pledging that their parents were coming. And then on the day of the meeting, we had just droves and droves of parents. We had, we have a staff of about, I guess, all together, approximately 60 people. So being the opportunity, not the opportunist so much as the, I just knew it was going to happen. See, so I said to the parents, to the teachers, don't sit in the seats. You have to sit on the side, bring in folding chairs so you'll not take up the seats of the parents. It was a funny thing. Nobody believed it. I just knew it was going to happen. And all the parents came, and we had a tremendous meeting. I liked to perform, and I came down front, and I told them from whence I came and where we were all going to go together, and I kind of made a show out of it. And parents were excited when it was over. Children were excited. Teachers were excited that many parents came.
Where did you tell them you were going to go?
We were going to make Blaine School one of the best schools in Philadelphia. I knew it could happen. That sort of thing. When I first spoke in terms of the school being pretty, that it had to be clean and it had to sparkle, many parents said to me, you are not in the suburbs, you must not know where you are. That sort of thing. And then as I kept saying to them, it doesn't make any difference what's on the outside. It's what's on the inside that counts. We can make the inside be whatever we want it to be. And I think they believe it, and it happened.
How did you do that?
We cleaned it up. We shined it. Well, we came in initially and cleaned it. Cleaned things like built-up wax that had been there and caused the floor to be dull. And we just took paint scrapers and egg turners, and we scraped up, literally scraped up the built-up wax from the edges and the corners. We just dug dirt out of the corners. We went to the boys' room and the girls' rooms with scrub brushes and scrubbed the concrete until there was no odor at all. We finished all of that. It was clean, as clean could be. The dirt that you could touch and move was gone, but it still lacked the sparkle that I wanted it to have. So we tried, the walls are cinder block, as are most of the walls in the newer buildings, and the dirt gets in the crevices. Even from washing, the dirt gets in the crevices. So then we needed to paint it. So we called downtown to ask to have it painted. We were told that we were 17 on the painting list. Now, 17, they were doing no painting. It's like never. So then we thought and did little odd things and strange things, and finally we had the building painted by going the political route, which is all, it's just not always the way to go. It usually is not the way to go. But in this particular instant, I just couldn't stop at, you have to wait, it can't happen. I just couldn't let it stop there, because that was the kind of feeling that the parents had when I came, is that you have to wait, you can't make it happen. So getting the building painted became of just paramount importance to me. I had to make it happen to make believers out of everybody.
What strings did you pull to get the paint job?
Well, we went through city council and from there through to the mayor and then back into the school system. And they called up. Mayor Rizzo at that time had 8 more months in office, and his words were, 8 months in office is long enough to paint a school. So he had the school painted, and everybody was happy. Then they believed. They believed that it was going to be different, that paint seemed to make the difference. When we left in September, we were promised that they would paint over the summer. So we put all the books away and all the bookcases away from the wall, just virtually cleaned the school of teacher materials. Materials the teachers had stacked on the shelves for 20 years. And everybody was still doubtful as to whether it would happen. So during the summer, I was on the telephone daily calling to see if it was going to happen. And it happened. And when we came back in September, it wasn't done. We came back in September, it wasn't done. It was still going to be done any day. They kept saying tomorrow, tomorrow. But I knew it was going to happen because the mayor had spoken. The superintendent of schools had promised me it would happen. So I knew it was going to happen. But teachers and parents and children still did not know. They had not talked to the mayor. They had not talked to the superintendent. So they still did not know it was going to happen. And then one day the painters all showed up with the paint and they began to paint. They painted while we were there. So they said to me, to paint with the school, with children and class going on, just can be so chaotic. I said, we could live with the chaos. And we did. We just moved around from room to room. We were lucky. We had about 4 empty rooms. So we could move classes as they painted. We shut off ends of the hall as they painted. They painted at night. So it was done. And all of a sudden, Blaine sparkled. We have colors that are really different from other schools. We have a bright, bright green in the office. Brightest green you ever saw, like a new green apple in the spring. And the shades are mini blinds, custom. They're the same color green as the paint on the cabinets and the counters. So as the teachers came, we had that done when they came back in September. The parents did that themselves. We painted that. So when they came back, the office was bright and shiny. We washed the windows and they were shut. We washed all the windows in the whole school. We washed all the windows. So that was, it looked clean, see. And then the paint came and then everybody got excited. They began to believe that some of the things I was saying wasn't just crazy. You know, they could happen.
I could see why that paint became so symbolic, because I know when you walk into an institution, probably there's been a lot of people before you have made promises that they couldn't fulfill. And I think people are very skeptical about someone who comes in with a lot of idealism and they say they're going to change this and that. And everyone sits back and says, yeah, prove it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So were there other things you had to do to prove yourself before you had the support of the parent community and teachers?
No, I think that when the parents came out for the big meeting, I think teachers began to know that something was going to happen. I think when the building, when everybody was doing what he was assigned to do, I think teachers began to think something was going to happen. And then, too, I took part in every part of it. With the yard, I felt that to have trash on the yard said something about the school. So I asked the youngsters to pick it up. Now, sometimes parents object to youngsters helping to clean. They feel that the cleaning should be done by the custodial staff, and the youngsters should not be doing that. So what I would do is I would come in, and I would take a broom and a dustpan and go out in the morning, and I would sweep the yard. So youngsters began to do it. Parents began to help so that it became all right, so that we didn't have one complaint about youngsters sweeping the yard or picking up trash. I said to the youngsters, if the custodian is going to come out here and pick up trash, think of all the other things that he could be doing for us he's not doing. Changing a light bulb, changing a shade, washing a window. Things that custodians do not do basically in schools. Our custodian did because we relieved him of the sweeping of the yard. Now, our yard is nearly a block large. The school sits almost on a city block. So the yard is big. To sweep that yard takes hours. So I said to the children, we'll pick up the paper and the custodian can do other things. Now, the custodian also sweeps around the school. So we have 500-600 kids. So we made a big line. We walked around the city block. And we said in order to get back into the school, everybody had to have a piece of trash. So by the time we got halfway around that yard, well, the youngsters, number 400 and 500, wasn't any paper left for them to pick up. So by the time we got back to the yard, the kids were tearing at the paper, sharing it with each other. So everybody would have a ticket back into the yard. And subsequently, the whole block was free of paper. We got community support by their watching this. See, parents, we're sided by families. Families live on all sides of the school. And the school being dirty is unsightly for them to sit on their porches and see. So that they watched that happen. We put the trash out. Shouldn't say this, but we did. So we put the trash out. The trash is picked up 1:30, 2 o'clock. Sometimes, for whatever reason, you know, sometimes trash is not picked up. If you leave trash out there, you have dogs pulling through it, and this trash is up and down the yard. So I immediately said the trash could not stay on that corner overnight. It must be picked up or moved off the corner. So the custodian said to me, you cannot bring that trash. He could not bring that trash back into the school. It's against the rules, fire rules, everything else. And I felt to leave it on that corner for us to come in the next morning to see trash all over was against somebody's rules. It ought to be. So that what I did is after the custodian left, I and a couple of kids went out there and picked up all the trash, put it back in the bags, and brought the trash back in. And then I allowed the lady across the street from the school to call me at home if the trash had not been picked up and that it was scattered about. And I would come down on Saturday, and me and the children would pick it up, put it back in the bags, bring it back into the school, and sneak it back out on Monday morning.
Didn't you ever say to yourself, shouldn't the custodians be taking care of all this sweeping and business about the trash?
Oh, no. See, the trash, the custodian did his part. He put the trash out. Now, the trash men were supposed to pick it up. They didn't pick it up. So he really had done his part. I still have just the best custodian in the world. Oh, he was new too. That was a blessing. I've been lucky in a lot of the things that have happened for us, in that he was new. So as I began to say this ought to be better, it wasn't criticism of him. It was like how he found it. It was just like how I found it. So together we brought it together. Oh, I said to him, I know that's difficult, impossible for you and your staff to get up dirt that's been there for 10 years. So we're all going to help you get it up, but you and your staff can keep it up. And he has. He got up a lot that we didn't get up. You know, he's just taken up a kind of a pride in the building. He does things that are above and beyond his call.
Madeline Cartwright is my guest, and she's the principal of the Blaine Elementary School in the Strawberry Mansion section of Philadelphia. The image that principals frequently try to give to the students in the school is of somebody who's very stern, a disciplinarian, and principals a lot of times spend a good deal of their day walking through the halls just looking mean to instill fear in the hearts of students so that they'll know that there's a real disciplinary force there who's going to catch them if they're doing something wrong. What kind of relationship do you want to have with your students, and what kind of image do you want them to have of you?
Okay, I know that you have to have an image such that youngsters know that you are the leader, that they do have to do what you say. In Blaine, I say to youngsters, you have to do what I say and what all of our staff says. That's important. And we make that important. I don't think that you can establish a kind of relationship with youngsters such as your buddy-buddy and your equal. I'm friendly with the youngsters to no end. The hugging and kissing that goes on in Blaine is just, it's unbelievable, really. I just get maybe 50 kisses a day. But still with that, they know that it's important to toe the line, that things must happen. I can stop smiling mid-smile and say that's not acceptable behavior. And they can stop it mid unacceptable behavior too and change it. You know, so that's the kind of relationship we have. I say to them all the time is I will do for you all that I can, but you must help me. And what I'm hearing, what we're hearing all about is trying to educate you. And we can't do that unless you help us. See? So if a youngster gets too far out, I'll say to him, is that how I treat you? When you ask me for something, what do I do? Do I try to help you? If I try to help you, then I need you to help me. And that sort of thing seems to work. I say to them that if I'm not successful with educating them, with keeping the school up, I said, now suppose Dr. Clayton would come here and she saw trash on the yard. I said, she would say, well, these kids don't care how we do. I said, that would affect me. I said, maybe I wouldn't even have a job. So they want that I should keep the job. They want that we should be successful, so we work together.
What's your approach to discipline in the school?
Oh, discipline, I think, is the function of the school. I think that what happened with discipline, this is Madeline here. Just what I'm saying is not someone else. Just my own opinion on how well-founded it is or any of that. But I think that what happened to discipline across this country is that we turned the discipline of the children over to the parents and expected the parents to discipline the children from home, such that we'd say to a youngster, as soon as the youngster has done the least little thing, we're going to call your mother. So I think youngsters begin to feel that we were the messengers between them and their mothers. And how many messages can a messenger take and still be effective? How many messages is a parent going to receive and wonder how effective we are if we're doing our jobs? So that I kind of feel, not kind of, I really feel, that the principal, the teachers, and the school staff should do all that we can to make youngsters responsive and responsible to us. And only when we can't achieve that individually, working with individual children, or group-wise, working with the counselor or the principal or the teacher all together, when that doesn't work, then I feel we should bring the parent in. And then we and the parent will discuss what all we have done within the school to make it happen. What can you and I do together? What can you and I mean the school and the home do together to bring about the changes in behavior that we want? And at that point, only that point, do I think the parent should be involved.
So what are your disciplinary tools?
Well, One is the conference. We have a referral form that's district-wide. That's if the teacher has a problem with the youngster and she has done all that she can in the classroom to adjust that behavior problem, then she sends the discipline referral form to the principal or the disciplinarian. In our case, she sends it to me. We don't have a vice principal or an administrative assistant in our school at this time. I'll look at the pink slip. Look at what the teacher has done. There on the pink slip, it says conferences with parents. Have you called the parent? Now, I have asked teachers not to do the conference with a parent until they've had the conference with me first so that I will know what the problem is, so that I can see how many similar problems are happening in that classroom. If you see that in a particular classroom there are 20 similar problems, you can begin to look other than the children. And that's the kind of thing that you can look at before the parent is involved. I think to involve a parent, the first level, when 5 or 6 parents can get together and see that this problem is big, then they begin to attack us and not be so much so supportive of us feeling that the problem is you and not our children. And there's nothing you've done about that first. That's one of the reasons why I insist on knowing the problem in my office before it goes outside. I don't suspend. I shouldn't say I don't suspend. I should say I haven't suspended. I think that I would suspend only, and I have not yet, I would only suspend if I should run into an elementary youngster whom I feel is a clear and present danger to the physical body of himself, other children, or the teacher. That's the only time. And I have not run into that youngster yet whom I could not contain there in the building in some fashion. To send a youngster home from school is depriving that youngster of, one, his right to education. That's a right he has. And I think I just have to think long and hard before I do that. And I say, if I were to send this youngster home, what is going to happen at home? What is going to happen? Why am I sending him home? I'm going to send him home at 3 o'clock anyway. So what's going to happen all day tomorrow that could not happen from 3 until bedtime? Or from 6 until the time he leaves, the time he gets up until he leaves in the morning, the conferences that his mother is going to have with him, or the program that she's going to put him on to adjust his behavior, could she not discuss that with him just as well at 3? I think there are, and I'm not saying the suspension should not be. I think there are some areas where a suspension may be an all right tool. But in my particular area, I don't see it as an all right tool. I've always worked in a poverty area. I have seen youngsters go out on suspension who are riding their bicycles around the schoolyard the next day.
What are your alternatives then? You can talk to the child, but do you have a punishment, or do you think that that's an appropriate way of dealing with behavior problems?
Yeah, okay, I spank. I try to respond to the behavior infraction as I feel the youngster expects me to respond. You can talk to a youngster and you can see that he's just walking to the office and saying to that, you can see his mechanism, his change mechanism going into effect when he just sees you. And then there's another who's going to hold forth to see if you're going to do anything else. So that youngster, I'm going to do something else. See? And I try to respond to the youngster as I think he's going to. I start off with the talking and I watch him to see if he's changing. I don't spank a youngster without his permission.
Wait, what do you ask them if it's okay?
Well, kind of. How I ask it if it's okay. If I decide that I'm going to spank this kid, I think it's going to make it better. I'll say to him, I'm going to spank you. And I watch his expression. See? And then I say, turn around and bend over. Now, if the youngster turns around and bends over, he's giving you his permission. If he doesn't, he's not. And if he doesn't turn around and bend over, I do not spank him.
What do you
do
then?
At that point, I call his mother. And I ask her to come in, and we talk about it.
Wouldn't some people say it's bad to back down like that if you said you're going to spank
him
and ask him to turn around?
Oh, no. To spank a youngster who does not agree that spanking is an order, I think, will do more harm than good. Just make him angry. He thinks it's not fair. And I think that a youngster has to come out of that office thinking that what you did to him was fair, or his behavior is not going to adjust. He's going to build up resentment. And resentment does not make for the kind of school atmosphere or the kind of learning atmosphere that you need. You need a fair feeling from children. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that behavior problems aren't as bad in schools where there's a lot of rapport between the administration, teachers and students and parents?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. I think when there is not a lot of just interaction, youngsters feel that what happens at school stays at school. And you will only tell his parent when you're going to suspend him. And you're not going to suspend him every day. He knows that. So that when youngsters know that you're going to see his mother from time to time, you'll be talking about her about anything, to her about anything. She's going to call the school. We have our phones. We put our phone number on everything we send out. So parents know they can call the school. They can come in, and they do. That I'm on the yard. The teachers are on the yard, and they're talking with parents all the time. So youngsters they know all the teachers, too. Don't just know their own. They know many, many teachers. That's one of the advantages to the assembly programs. Some schools don't have assembly programs. But the assembly program allows the youngsters to meet more teachers than just his one. He begins to meet other teachers. He begins to interact with children. He begins to see what's happening in other classrooms. See, assembly programs bring parents in, too. And parents begin to see what is happening in the classrooms. That sort of thing makes youngsters know that what is happening in school is not contained in the school, that it has something to do with behavior.
My guest is Madeline Cartwright, and she's the principal of the Blaine Elementary School in the Strawberry Mansion section of Philadelphia. And we're talking about her approach to running that school. Explain why you brought in the washing machine and sewing machine and how they're used now.
Okay, we have a washer, a dryer, and a sewing machine, and that is called our grooming center. And we have that available to any youngster who wants to use it. Our parents are young, and many, many times to sew up a seam will save a coat. Will save a youngster's embarrassment, too. I've had youngsters come in the morning and say to me, "Mommy said, could you sew this right quick?" And we go and sew it. How long does it take to sew a seam or sew up a hole? Pop on a button. We have a little button. It would pop right on a button. I'll put in a zipper that would keep a coat from going out. Some youngsters don't have the advantage of parents who are able and to keep their clothing up. And I feel that youngsters shouldn't suffer because they don't have that advantage. So we provide it for them. Now, in some instances, we change the youngster's clothes right there in school and provide him with clean clothes. We only do that if the youngster has an odor. Then we'll just change the clothing right then and give him clean clothes and wash his. But if a youngster is just generally untidy, we'll say to them, we'll call them off to the side, and we'll say to them, if you bring those clothes to school in a bag, we'll wash them for you. Just put them down, and we'll wash them for you and put them back. You can pick them up and take them home, and then you'll be clean. And we say that to parents. We say to parents, if there's a problem that you cannot do your youngster's clothing, rather than send him dirty, send the clothes. And some parents do. They may be sick or have four or five kids. And four or five kids and you miss one trip to the laundromat really backs you up. So we allow them to send the youngster's clothing, not sheets, towels, and all that, just that youngster's clothing he's allowed to bring in. They do that. We have a coat wash. The coat wash is a fun thing. We wash coats every day. And that's most coats now, we're very lucky, most coats now are washable. They were washed. Even some of the ones that say don't wash, they washed it. And we only lost one. Only lost one coat where it said don't wash, I washed. It came out two sizes too small. But quickly, I called the home and school president, told her what happened. She called through the home and school, and just like that, we had another coat to replace that one. Within an hour, I had another coat. I said, I need a size 7 coat. I shrunk it. Within an hour, I had a size 7 coat to send home with that kid. Youngsters take their coats off, and they drop them. And they say, "Miss Carbat, you going to the coat wash today?" And I'll drop her coat. And we take her to coat wash. I wash my coat there, too. I often bring a coat that I can drop in. See, Nelson, we wash mine, too. So it's all right. See, you take, in the area where we are, it's difficult for parents to provide a couple of coats. Got one coat. And if the mother has to go to the laundromat with that one coat, what's the kid wearing? Does she leave him home? Does she take him with her? So it's difficult to wash that coat. So usually that coat is washed during the holiday. See? And so we wash them. Every day we wash coats. And youngsters like it. They'll say, we're going out on Sunday. Could you wash my coat on Friday?
I think a lot of people would be afraid to start on a project like that, fearing that parents or children would take advantage of them.
They don't.
And abuse the privilege.
They don't. They just don't.
Who does the actual washing?
Everybody. Teachers do it. Teachers who are around will do it. They'll bring their kids' coats out of their classrooms and do it. The librarian picks up most of it. And why she picks up most of it is the washing machine and dryers in front of the library. So when the washing machine stops, she'll go over and put them in the dryer. Or somebody from her office will do it. You know, basically she does the turnover. But just anybody will start the wash.
Do people ever suggest to you that maybe you're setting a bad precedent because, after all, society already expects so much from the schools. They expect schools to solve social problems and economic problems and racial tensions that exist in society, but somehow it's all supposed to be perfect in the school. And it's very difficult for most teachers and principals to pull that off. And you're saying, yes, and we're going to do that, and we're going to wash their clothes, too. Do people ever fear that you're setting a standard that's really too high for most schools to live up to, and that you're taking on more than other schools would ever care to?
Yeah, I think so. I think people have said that to me. They've said, where do you get the energy? I could never do all that. And it's just a different, it's kind of a, different people can do different things. You know what I mean? And wherein I'm doing that, perhaps they can have another program that's as effective. I'm not saying every school should have a washer and a dryer. I think that if the school, like I know that other parents have heard of our school. I think if those parents came to the school and said, I think we should have a washer and dryer, and they know that it's not the laundromat, and I don't have any problem saying that to parents. I say, this is not the laundromat. You may not use this for the laundromat. You may only use this in the cases of emergency. You may. But the youngster in a given day can, as many want, who want to use it. I don't allow a parent. No parent brings his clothes in and washes. That's just not done. You have to be strong enough to do that. So if you can't pull that off, you can't have the washer and dryer. But I think that I'm sure that folks think sometimes we do too much.
Do you ever think you do too much, or is there no such thing?
No, I don't. I don't think so. I don't think it's too much. You know, if I didn't have the time to do it, you know, if I were drained, I just have a lot of energy. And everybody helps. You know, everybody helps to do it. The children can, we have a couple of kids that can run the washer and dryer. And they can do it. The parents can do it, you know. Anybody will mop. Anybody in the school will mop. A parent, a child, if someone spills something on the floor, before the day is over, someone will get that up. I mean, everybody knows where the mop is, and they'll go and get it and mop it up. Once a parent said to me that the front stairs weren't swept, and it was kind of tickled me, too, because I thought of the trash that was on the yard when I came, and all of a sudden the front stairs weren't swept one day, and they should complain about it. So the parent said to me, you know, the front stairs weren't swept. I said, they weren't. Let's sweep them. And I got a brush. I handed her one, and I got one, and we swept down the front stairs. See, and it was all. She didn't say a word. She didn't say a word. She helped sweep it. She didn't say a word.
My guest is Madeline Cartwright, the principal of the Blaine Elementary School in the Strawberry Mansion section of Philadelphia. Were there curriculum changes that you made when you arrived at the school?
Yes, yes. I questioned the use of the school courses of study. There's a course of study for every subject. I found that many teachers didn't have them, were not using them. And I made a joke. And the joke was, someone asked me, someone higher than I, asked me if I, with all the other things you're doing, are you keeping on top of your curriculum? I said, certainly I am. And they said, does every teacher have a course of study? I said, certainly they do. 700 of them. She said, you have sufficient. I said, yes. She said, how many do you have? I said, 700. She said, 700 guys, teacher guides. I said, yes. California Achievement Test was our guide to our curriculum. And everybody had one for every kid, see? So it was a little joke, but it was true. That's what it was. Many, many teachers used the California Achievement Test to take the material from which they're going to teach. They felt that if they didn't teach that material and the youngsters didn't do well on the test, then it looked like they were not a good teacher. Or it looked like the school wasn't a good school and the principal wasn't doing his job. So this was kind of the way of life. And I refused for that to be the course of study.
What did you substitute it with?
The teacher's guides. We had all along. You're supposed to use them. So we used them.
How has the school's grades changed on the achievement test?
We're improving. We are. We went rock bottom. It was kind of a shocking thing for a lot of folks. It wasn't so much shocking that it happened. It was a shocking thing that we did it. We allowed it to happen was the shock. I talked with the teachers about it, and I said, let's find out where our youngsters are. Let's not be hung up on this test sort of thing. Let's just give this test. If it says the children are supposed to do it for 15 minutes, let's do it for 15 minutes. Let's not teach the lesson and make the test the follow-up to the lesson. And that's what was happening in many instances. A given part of the test may have had 20 questions. What happened in many instances, the teacher would teach a lesson on that area. And then the follow-up to the lesson she taught was the California Achievement Test, the actual test. So that youngsters, having just been reviewed or retaught or just taught, would do better than what should have happened, is that this course of learning should have gone on over the year. At the end of that time, you should give the test, not teach each portion of it, and see what happened. Teachers went along with it, and we did it. We had folks sitting in every classroom to make sure they adhered to the time schedule, to make sure they did not teach the lesson before they gave the test, and the scores went plukup, right straight down. And teachers had alerted me when I came in that the test scores were not what they should be. And as I looked at it, in one instance, we had over 80% of the children over the 80th percentile. You know, that's crazy, see? So anyway, it kind of gave us a picture. And you need a picture. You need a picture so you can know where you were going, to see where you are. And it's difficult to tell where you're going if you don't first know where you are. And we did the test. When it came back, we looked at it. We saw what areas need to be taught. And we began to say, well, we're going to take this program. I talked about 233B, which was a course of study for the Pennsylvania, you know, issued from Harrisburg some years back. And we talked about what should be taught in each class, each grade. Let's teach that and let's test and see what happens. Let's make sure the youngsters have materials that they need. We started this pencil sale business. That's a big thing there too. We buy, I guess we must buy 100 gross pencils a year. I mean, you just buy pencils, and it's like they eat them. They come in the morning, the same kid might buy 4 pencils on Monday, that same kid buys 4 more Wednesday. See? So we make sure they have pencils. And they can buy the pencils if they have the money. If they don't have the money, they can charge them. They can pay us when they get the money. But we tell them they have to have a pencil. You have to have a pencil. You have to have a book, a homework book. And you have to write in your homework book. That's because if you give a youngster his homework and a piece of paper, he could lose it. He could drop it. We tell him that his homework book has to be in a bag. Let it be a book bag, a grocery bag, a shoe bag, or whatever kind of bag you want. But it has to be in a bag. And we walk around through the yard and say, where's your bag? We have, we tell the teachers, anything you buy, try to get 2 bags. Teachers bring in shoe bags, blouse bags, whatever. And in grocery bags, we pass them over to the kids, especially the little plastic ones. See? And then we had a candy sale. The man gave us some bags for candy. So then I told him, I said, listen, we sold candy, you made money. Give me another box of bags for my kids to carry the homework books home next week. So he sent them. So he gave us 500 bags. 500 bags don't last a long time, but they last a while. And along with what we're bringing in. So every youngster has some kind of a bag to put his book in. Every youngster has a book. Every youngster has a pencil. And that also helps to maintain our books that we send home. You send a kid a book that costs $7 home in his hand. He drops it. Or just holding it. Just holding a book itself is your hand is sweating, wearing the book. So that all that helps to keep the books in better shape. It helps the youngster to have the materials that he needs when he gets home. It helps his mother to know that there's some organization in the school.
Do you think that when the youngster knows that you value those books so much that they'd better be covered with a bag, that they start to value it more by your
sure
example?
Oh, sure I do. They begin to look at each other's. His book looks better than mine. And I'll say it, too. How come your book doesn't look as good as his? And he knows it's because he doesn't take care of it. So now he begins to take care of it.
Do you not believe in standardized tests? Do you think that they do more harm than good because of this?
No, I believe in standardized tests.
Uh-huh.
I believe it's necessary. I think it's necessary in order to compare yourself with other schools throughout the country. And that's what youngsters are going to be compared with throughout their lives, through other school results of other schools throughout the country. So I think that's necessary. I think that standardized tests should be used as they are meant to be used. That they should be given honestly. They should not measure teachers so much as they measure what is being done. And you can look at your program, revamp your program through the testing.
One of the real problems in the schools is that there's it's such a hard job teaching and there's so much work to do that teachers really experience burnout because there's, you're on all the time. You're performing for lots of different students. In junior high and high school, you've got 4 or 5 different classes a day. There's papers to take home and grade, and then lessons to prepare that night. Is there anything that you think you can do as a principal to help with that problem of burnout?
Sure. I think that all the things you've said is performing before children daily, being prepared, all that does take a lot of energy. I think a lot more energy is lost when teachers feel threatened, when they don't feel like they're a part of a team, when they feel put upon. All those things, I think, make for burnout. We don't have a low group in the school. Not such thing as a low group, you know, the high group and the middle group and the low group. I think a teacher who's saddled with what is, quote, a low group doesn't feel success. And I think the lacking of the feeling of success makes it is stressful. And I think burnout is a result of stress. I think that the atmosphere of the building, all those things add to burnout. And I think that we can help it by supporting each other, that we can help it by making sure in every way that we can that teachers are successful. Those things are what it takes to refuel the fire.
When you were a teacher before you became a principal, you were active in the union and the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers. Now, Philadelphia has been a city in which there's been many long strikes. Did you experience a lot of conflict during those strikes between wanting to fight for what you thought was just for the teachers and then wanting to be in school where your students were?
No. No, I didn't. When I was with the teachers' union and as a teacher, each one of the strikes, I felt I was very active in the union. I thought that we did not have a contract. I didn't think we could work without a contract. I didn't think that the teachers' union was the cause of the strike. I thought the whole thing was bigger than that picket line in front of that school. And I thought it was necessary for us to do the things that we did in order to bring about that thing you were talking about, the dignity that allows teachers to feel like somebody and not experience the kind of stress that would cause the burnout. And I feel that teachers have to have dignity. And I think if the strike is what you have to have a strike, I mean, to have a contract, then that's what it was.
Do you still feel that way as a principal now that you're not in the union and you're an administrator? And I think there's sometimes a kind of typical employer-employee or labor management split in schools.
Yeah, see, even though I was active in the union, I was never far enough to the top that I could determine whether we had the strike or didn't, or what issues we had it, or whether I could give or take, or what we could give or take. The same thing on this side of it. Now I'm on the administrative side of it, and I think that the strike is something that local school principals and teachers have to make the best out of the situation. I said it during the last strike, there is nothing that I can do on this corner. There's nothing the teachers can do on this corner. I mean 30th and Burke's corner. That's going to make anything happen downtown. We have to make the best out of this and hope that we can have it settled as soon as possible. And that's the kind of philosophy that I gave to parents, to teachers, and children. I did not feel any antagonism to the teachers that stayed out. I felt no antagonism to the ones who came in. I figured that each person had to make his own decision and be guided by that. My job was to keep the school open and maintain educational program as close to normal as possible. As a principal, I tried to do that. I explained to teachers what my job was and that I'd be about the business of doing it. And I was.
Do you have any suggestions for parents who want to improve the conditions in the school that their child attends but don't know exactly what power they'd have to do that?
I think they have to come in and talk with the principal. I think they have to be active in the Home and School Association. I think there is not one. They should form one. They can form one with 2 parents. Soon you'll have 3. Soon you'll have 4. Soon you'll have 5. I think that the more visible the parents are in the building, the more the parents know about the building. I think that if they don't know and they want to know, then they should hook themselves up with a school that has an active Home and School Association. Attend their meeting, see what they do. Come back and try it on in your school. Have them come over. There's a Home and School Council that's helpful. we'll come over and help them organize. But I think if parents are going to make a difference, they have to be active participants in the building.
If you had the ability to change any systemic things in the Philadelphia schools, what would you change?
I don't know. I'm going to leave it there. I don't know.
Okay. What are your most vivid memories from when you were in elementary school? Did you have a positive experience as a youngster?
As an elementary youngster, my experiences were not very positive. My mother was not active in the school. I found then that youngsters whose parents were active were the youngsters who got top shelf treatment. I found that even as a kid. Now, my mother was not active. She worked. She had a lot of kids. She had to work. So she was not active in the school at all. So I said, if my mother were here, that kid would not be standing up there talking. I'd be standing up there. You see? And that often was the case. The youngsters whose parents are active are youngsters who get the big roles in the plays. The youngsters get to be the announcers, get to be the school messengers. Those things happen. So that I make sure now, too, that youngsters whose parents are not active, that they get a play also. I found my elementary school principal was not the friendly type. He was the authoritarian principal. And seemed insensitive to me to the real feelings of children. I think it has a lot to do with how I treat children, too. Even though he was an excellent administrator, but he seemed insensitive to me as to how I felt about what he said or how anybody felt about what he said. You know, I remember him one day really hurt my feelings. I'm not going to tell you what he said, though. It really hurt my feelings. And I said, you know, I would never say that to a kid. So what I do now is I don't say that to a kid. And I try to fix it so the kid is not in the fix for someone else to say it to him. Now, junior high school was a little different. And plus, in elementary school, I was not successful. I didn't read until the fourth grade. So I was not successful. So I knew, too, the feeling of not being successful. And then for some kind of way, by fourth grade or so, I began to see how you could look at these letters and get words. It just kind of clicked. And I said, how could that happen? You know, I mean, why didn't I see that yesterday? So that, and I tell the kids that. I tell my kids, you know, I didn't read to the fourth grade. So there's hope. If you can't read, just keep plugging. It might happen. Maybe you can't count, but keep plugging. It might happen. Because you see, eventually I learned to read. And I was a good reader. And you may be too. Because I went from being the bottom of the class in the first, second, and third grade to the top of the class in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th. You see. So that as I begin to be successful, I begin to like school more. So, you know, I know about kids. If they're successful, they'll like school more.
Well, that's a nice note to end on. I want to thank you so much. It's really been an interesting hour. Thanks a lot for being here.
Certainly, I enjoyed coming.